Chapter 7. Stand Up to the Bullies. If you want to change the world, don't back down from the sharks. The water off San Clemente Island was choppy and cold as we began our four-mile night swim. Ensign Mark Thomas was matching my side strokes one for one. With nothing but a loose-fitting wetsuit top, a mask, and a pair of fins, we swam hard against the current that was pushing southward around the small peninsula. The lights of the naval base, from which we had started, began to fade as we made our way out into the open ocean. Within an hour, we were about a mile off the beach and seemingly all alone in the water. Whatever swimmers were around us were cloaked in darkness. I could see Mark's eyes through the glass in his face mask. His expression must have mirrored mine. We both knew that the waters off San Clemente Island were filled with sharks. Not just any shark, but the great white shark, the largest, most aggressive man-eater in the ocean. Prior to our swim, the SEAL instructors had given us a briefing on all the potential threats we might encounter that night. There were leopard sharks, mako sharks, hammerhead sharks, thresher sharks, but the one we feared the most was the great white. There was something a little unnerving about being alone at night in the middle of the ocean, knowing that lurking beneath the surface was a prehistoric creature just waiting to bite you in half. But we both wanted to be SEALs so badly that nothing in the water that night was going to stop us. If we had to fight off the sharks, then we were both prepared to do so. Our goal, which we believed to be honorable and noble, gave us courage, and courage is a remarkable quality. Nothing and nobody can stand in your way. Without it, others will define your path forward. Without it, you are at the mercy of life's temptations. Without courage, men will be ruled by tyrants and despots. Without courage, no great society can flourish. Without courage, the bullies of the world rise up. With it, you can accomplish any goal. With it, you can defy and defeat evil. Saddam Hussein, the now former president of Iraq, sat on the edge of an old army cot, clad only in an orange jumpsuit. Having been captured by U.S. forces 24 hours earlier, he was now a prisoner of the United States. As I opened the door to allow the new Iraqi government leaders into the room, Saddam remained seated. A smirk crossed his face, and there was no sign of remorse or submission in his attitude. Immediately, the four Iraqi leaders began to yell at Saddam, but from a safe distance. With a look of contempt, Saddam gave them a deadly smile and motioned them to sit down. Still fearful of the former dictator, they each grabbed a folding chair and took their seats. The screaming and finger-pointing continued, but slowly subsided as the former dictator began to talk. Under Saddam Hussein, the Ba'ath Party was responsible for the deaths of thousands of Shia Iraqis and tens of thousands of Kurds. Saddam had personally executed a number of his own generals whom he felt were disloyal. Although I was positive Saddam would no longer be a threat to the other men in the room, the Iraqi leaders were not so certain. The fear in their eyes was unmistakable. This man, the butcher of Baghdad, had for decades terrorized an entire nation. His cult of personality had drawn to him followers of the worst sort. His murderous thugs had brutalized the innocent and forced thousands to flee the country. No one in Iraq had mustered the courage to challenge the tyrant. There was no doubt in my mind that these new leaders were still terrified of what Saddam might be able to do, even from behind bars. If the purpose of the meeting was to show Saddam that he was no longer in power, it had failed. In those brief moments, Saddam had managed to intimidate and frighten the new regime leadership. He seemed more confident than ever. As the Iraqi leaders left, I instructed my guards to isolate the former president in a small room. There would be no visitors, and the guards in the room were ordered not to talk with Saddam. Over the next month, I visited the small room every day, and every day Saddam rose to greet me, and every day without speaking, I motioned him back to his cot. The message was clear. He was no longer important. He could no longer intimidate those around him. He could no longer instill fear into his subjects. Gone was the gleaming palace. Gone were the handmaidens, the servants, and the generals. Gone was the power. The arrogance and oppressiveness that had defined his rule had ended. Courageous young American soldiers had stood up to his tyranny, and now he was no longer a threat to anyone. 30 days later, I transferred Saddam Hussein to a proper military police unit, and a year later, the Iraqis hanged him for his crimes against the nation. Bullies are all the same, whether they are in the schoolyard, in the workplace, or ruling a country through terror. They thrive on fear and intimidation. Bullies gain their strength through the timid and faint of heart. They are like sharks that sense fear in the water. They will circle to see if their prey is struggling. They will probe to see if their victim is weak. If you don't find the courage to stand your ground, they will strike. In life, to achieve your goals, to complete the night swim, you will have to be men and women of great courage. That courage is within all of us. Dig deep, and you will find it in abundance. Chapter 8, Rise to the Occasion. If you want to change the world, be your very best in the darkest moments. I stood on the small sandy spit of land, looking across the bay at the line of warships that were moored at the 32nd Street Naval Base. In between the ships and our starting point was a small vessel anchored in San Diego Bay that would be this evening's target. Our training class had spent the last several months learning to dive the basic scuba and the more advanced, bubbleless, Emerson closed-circuit diving rig. Tonight was the culmination of dive phase, the most technically difficult part of basic SEAL training. Our objective was to swim the 2,000 meters underwater from the starting point across the bay to the anchored vessel. Once underneath the ship, we were to place our practice limpet mine on the keel and then, without being detected, return to the beach. The Emerson diving apparatus was morbidly referred to as the death rig. It was known to malfunction occasionally, and according to SEAL folklore, a number of trainees had died over the years using the Emerson. At night, the visibility in San Diego Bay was so bad that you couldn't see your hand in front of your face. All you had was a small green chemical light to illuminate your underwater compass. To make matters worse, the fog was rolling in. The haze hung low over the bay, making it difficult to take an initial compass bearing on our target. If you missed the target, you would find yourself in the shipping channel, never a good place to be when a Navy destroyer was pulling into port. The SEAL instructors paced back and forth in front of the 25 pairs of divers preparing for the night's dive. The instructors seemed as nervous as we were. They knew that this training event had the highest potential for someone to get hurt or die. The chief petty officer in charge of the event summoned all the divers into a small circle. "Gentlemen," he said, "tonight we find out which of you sailors really want to be frogmen." He paused for effect. "It's cold and dark out there. It will be darker under the ship, so dark that you can get disoriented, so dark that if you get separated from your swim buddy, he will not be able to find you." The fog was now closing in around us, and the mist encircled even the spit of land on which we stood. "Tonight, you will have to be your very best. You must rise above your fears, your doubts, and your fatigue. No matter how dark it gets, you must complete the mission. This is what separates you from everyone else." Somehow, those words stayed with me for the next 30 years. As I watched the fog encircle the airfield at Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan, another dark moment was unfolding in front of me. A massive C-17 aircraft was parked on the tarmac, its ramp lowered, standing by to receive the remains of a fallen warrior. This was a ramp ceremony. It was one of the most solemn and yet unquestionably inspiring aspects of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. It was America at its finest. Every man, every woman, regardless of their background, regardless of how heroic their final moment, was treated with incredible dignity and honor. It was the nation's way of recognizing their sacrifice. It was our last salute, our final thanks, and a prayer to send them on their way home. Extending out from the ramp were two parallel lines of soldiers. Standing at parade rest, they formed the honor guard. Off to the right of the airplane was a small three-piece band, softly playing Amazing Grace. A few others, myself included, were gathered to the left, and all along Hangar Row stood hundreds of other soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, civilians, and our allies. They had all come to pay their last respects. The Humvee tactical vehicle carrying the remains arrived right on time. Six men from the Fallen Heroes unit acted as pallbearers. Offloading the flag-draped casket, they slowly marched through the honor guard, up the ramp, and onto the plane. They positioned the casket in the middle of the cargo bay, turned smartly, came to attention, and saluted. At the head of the casket, the pastor bowed his head and read from Isaiah 6:8. And I heard the voice of the Lord saying, "Whom shall I send, and who will go for me?" And I said, "Here I am, send me." As Taps was played, tears rolled down the soldiers' eyes. There was no attempt to hide their grief. As the pallbearers departed, those lined up outside came through one by one, saluting and kneeling by the casket for one last thought. The C-17 would depart later that morning, refueling along the way and arriving at Dover Air Force Base. There, another honor guard, along with the family of the fallen soldier, would meet the casket and escort it home. There is no darker moment in life than losing someone you love. And yet I watched time and again as families, as military units, as towns, as cities, and as a nation, how we came together to be our best during those tragic times. When a seasoned Army special operator was killed in Iraq, his twin brother stood tall, comforting the soldier's friends, holding the family together, and ensuring that his lost brother would be proud of his strength in this time of need. When a fallen Ranger was returned home to his base in Savannah, Georgia, his entire unit, dressed in their finest uniforms, marched from the church to the Ranger's favorite bar on River Street. All along the route, the town of Savannah turned out firefighters, police officers, veterans, civilians from all walks of life were there to salute the young soldier who had died heroically in Afghanistan. When a CV-22 aircraft crashed in Afghanistan, killing the pilot and several crewmen, the airmen from the same unit came together, paid their respects, and flew the next day, knowing that their fallen brothers would want them in the air, continuing the mission. When a helicopter crash took the lives of 25 special operators and 6 National Guard soldiers, the entire nation mourned, but also took incredible pride in the courage, patriotism, and valor of the fallen warriors. At some point, we will all confront a dark moment in life. If not the passing of a loved one, then something else that crushes your spirit and leaves you wondering about your future. In that dark moment, reach deep inside yourself and be your very best. Chapter 9. Give People Hope. If you want to change the world, start singing when you're up to your neck in mud. The night wind coming off the ocean was gusting to 20 miles an hour. There was no moon out, and an evening layer of low clouds obscured the stars. I was sitting in chest-deep mud, covered from head to toe with a layer of grime. My vision blurred by the caked-on clay, I could see only the outline of my fellow students lined up in the pit beside me. It was Wednesday of Hell Week, and my SEAL training class was down at the infamous Tijuana Mud Flats. Hell Week was the seminal event for the first phase of SEAL training. It was 6 days of no sleep and unrelenting harassment by the instructors. There were long runs, open ocean swims, obstacle courses, rope climbs, endless sessions of calisthenics, and constant paddling of the inflatable boat Small. The purpose of Hell Week was to eliminate the weak, those not tough enough to be SEALs. Statistically speaking, more students quit during Hell Week than at any other time in training, and the mud flats were the toughest part of the week. Located between South San Diego and Mexico, the mud flats were a low-lying area where drainage from San Diego created a large swath of deep, thick mud that had the consistency of wet clay. Earlier that afternoon, our class had paddled our rubber boats from Coronado down to the mudflats. Soon after arriving, we were ordered into the mud and began a series of races and individual competitions designed to keep us cold, wet, and miserable. The mud clung to every part of your body. It was so dense that moving through it exhausted you and tested your will to carry on. For hours, the races continued. By the evening, we could barely move from the bone-chilling coldness and the fatigue. As the sun went down, the temperature dropped, the wind picked up, and everything seemed to get even harder. Morale was declining rapidly. It was only Wednesday, and we all knew that another 3 days of pain and exhaustion lay ahead. This was the moment of truth for a lot of the students. Shaking uncontrollably, with hands and feet swollen from nonstop use, and skin so tender that even the slightest movement brought discomfort, our hope for completing the training was fading fast. Silhouetted against the distant lights of the city, a SEAL instructor walked purposefully to the edge of the mudflats. Sounding like an old friend, he softly talked into a bullhorn and offered comfort to the suffering trainees. "We could join him and the other instructors by the fire," he said. "He had hot coffee and chicken soup. We could relax until the sun came up, get off our feet, take it easy." I could sense that some of the students were ready to accept his offer. After all, how much longer could we survive in the mud? A warm fire, hot coffee, and chicken soup sure sounded good. But then came the catch. All he needed was for five of us to quit. Just five quitters, and the rest of the class could have some relief from the pain. The student beside me started to move toward the instructor. I grabbed his arm and held him tight, but the urge to leave the mud was too great. He broke free of my grasp and began to lunge for dry ground. I could see the instructor smiling. He knew that once one man quit, others would follow. Suddenly, above the howl of the wind came a voice, singing. It was tired and raspy, but loud enough to be heard by all. The lyrics were not meant for tender ears, but everyone knew the tune. One voice became two, and two became three, and then before long, everyone was singing. The student rushing for the dry ground turned around and came back beside me. Looping his arm around mine, he began to sing as well. The instructor grabbed the bullhorn and shouted for the class to quit singing. No one did. He yelled at the class leader to get control of the trainees. The singing continued. With each threat from the instructor, the voices got louder, the class got stronger, and the will to continue on in the face of adversity became unbreakable. In the darkness, with the fire reflecting on the face of the instructor, I could see him smile. Once again, we had learned an important lesson: the power of one person to unite the group, the power of one person to inspire those around him, to give them hope. If that one person could sing while neck deep in mud, then so could we. If that one person could endure the freezing cold, then so could we. If that one person could hold on, then so could we. The large room at Dover Air Force Base was filled with grieving families, inconsolable children sobbing in their mother's arms, parents holding hands, hoping to gain strength from each other, and wives with a far-off look of disbelief. Just 5 days earlier, a helicopter carrying Navy SEALs, their Afghan special operations partners, and flown by Army aviators had been shot down in Afghanistan. All 38 men on board were killed. It was the single greatest loss in the War on Terror. In less than an hour, a large C-17 transport aircraft was scheduled to land at Dover, and the families of the fallen heroes would be escorted to the flight line to meet the flag-draped coffins. But as the families waited, the President of the United States, the Secretary of Defense, the service secretaries, and senior military leaders filed into the waiting room to pay their respects and give comfort where they could. I had attended dozens of services for fallen soldiers. It was never easy, and I often wondered whether my words of solace made any difference to those who lost loved ones, or whether the shock of their loss made everything I said incomprehensible. As my wife, George Ann, and I began to talk with the families, I struggled with the right words. How could I truly empathize with their pain? How could I tell them that the sacrifice of their son, their husband, their father, their brother, their friend was worth it? I did my best to console each one. I hugged them. I prayed with them. I tried to remain strong for them. But somehow I knew my words fell short. Then, as I knelt down beside an elderly woman, I noticed the family next to me talking with Marine Lieutenant General John Kelly. The military assistant to the Secretary of Defense, Kelly was tall, lean, with close-cropped gray hair and dressed in an immaculate Marine uniform. The family was gathered around him, and I could sense that his words of sympathy and encouragement in the face of this tragedy were having a profound effect on the grief-stricken parents and their children. He smiled, and they smiled. He hugged, and they hugged back. He reached out his hand, and they grasped it tightly. After embracing the parents one last time and thanking the family for their sacrifice, Kelly moved on to the next group of heartbroken survivors. During the next hour, John Kelly touched almost every family in the room. More than any other visitor that day, Kelly's words resonated with every parent, every wife, every brother and sister, and every friend. His words were words of understanding. His were words of compassion. And above all, his were words of hope. Only John Kelly could have made a difference that day. Only John Kelly could have given them hope, because only John Kelly knew what it was like to lose a son in combat. Marine First Lieutenant Robert Kelly was killed in Afghanistan in 2010 while serving with the 3rd Battalion, 5th Marines. General Kelly and his family had struggled with the tragedy, just like the families at Dover that day. But the Kelly family had survived. They had endured through the pain, the heartache, and the inconsolable sense of loss. As I watched him that day, he also gave me strength. The truth is, when you lose a soldier, you grieve for the families, but you also fear that that same fate may someday befall you. You wonder whether you could survive the loss of a child, or you wonder how your family would get along without you by their side. You hope and pray that God will be merciful and not have you shoulder this unthinkable burden. Over the course of the next 3 years, John Kelly and I became close friends. He was a remarkable officer, a strong husband to his wife Karen, and a loving father to his daughter Kate and oldest son, Marine Major John Kelly. But more than that, without ever knowing it, John Kelly gave all those around him hope. Hope that in the very worst of times, we could rise above the pain, the disappointment, and the agony, and be strong. That each of us had within us the ability to carry on, and not only to survive, but also to inspire others. Hope is the most powerful force in the universe. With hope, you can inspire nations to greatness. With hope, you can raise up the downtrodden. With hope, you can ease the pain of unbearable loss. Sometimes all it takes is one person to make a difference. We will all find ourselves neck deep in mud someday. That is the time to sing loudly, to smile broadly, to lift up those around you and give them hope that tomorrow will be a better day. Chapter 10. Never, ever quit. If you want to change the world, don't ever, ever ring the bell. I stood at attention, along with the other 150 students, beginning the first day of SEAL training. The instructor, dressed in combat boots, khaki shorts, and a blue and gold t-shirt, walked across the large asphalt courtyard to a brass bell hanging in full view of all the trainees. "Gentlemen," he began, "today is the first day of SEAL training. For the next 6 months, you will undergo the toughest course of instruction in the United States military." I glanced around and could see some looks of apprehension on the faces of my fellow students. The instructor continued, "You will be tested like no time in your life." Pausing, he looked around the class of new tadpoles. "Most of you will not make it through, and I will see to that." He smiled. "I will do everything in my power to make you quit." He emphasized the last three words. "I will harass you unmercifully. I will embarrass you in front of your teammates. I will push you beyond your limits." Then a slight grin crossed his face. "And there will be pain. Lots and lots of pain." Grabbing the bell, he pulled the rope hard, and a loud clanging noise echoed across the courtyard. "But if you don't like the pain, if you don't like all the harassment, then there is an easy way out. He pulled the rope again, and another wave of deep metallic sound reverberated off the buildings. All you have to do to quit is ring this bell 3 times. He let go of the rope tied to the bell's clapper. Ring the bell, and you won't have to get up early. Ring the bell, and you won't have to do the long runs, the cold swims, or the obstacle course. Ring the bell, and you can avoid all this pain. Then the instructor glanced down at the asphalt and seemed to break from his prepared monologue. "But let me tell you something," he said. "If you quit, you will regret it for the rest of your life. Quitting never makes anything easier." 6 months later, there were only 33 of us standing at graduation. Some had taken the easy way out. They had quit. And my guess is the instructor was right. They would regret it for the rest of their lives. Of all the lessons I learned in SEAL training, this was the most important. Never quit. It doesn't sound particularly profound, but life constantly puts you in situations where quitting seems so much easier than continuing on, where the odds are so stacked against you that giving up seems the rational thing to do. Throughout my career, I was constantly inspired by men and women who refused to quit, who refused to feel sorry for themselves, but none more so than a young Army Ranger I met in a hospital in Afghanistan. It was late one evening when I received word that one of my soldiers had stepped on a pressure plate mine and had been medevaced to the combat hospital near my headquarters. The Ranger Regimental Commander, Colonel Eric Carrilla, and I quickly made our way to the hospital and into the soldier's room. The soldier lay in the hospital bed, tubes extending from his mouth and chest, blast burns streaked up his arms and across his face. The blanket covering his body lay flat to the bed where his legs would normally have been. His life was now changed forever. I had made countless visits to the combat hospital in Afghanistan. As a wartime leader, you try not to internalize the human suffering. You know that it is part of combat. Men get wounded. Men die. If you allow every decision you make to be predicated on the possible loss of life, you will struggle mightily to be effective. Somehow, though, this night seemed different. The Ranger lying in front of me was so very young, younger than my 2 boys. He was 19 years old, and his name was Adam Bates. He had arrived in Afghanistan just a week earlier, and this had been his first combat mission. I leaned over and touched my hand to his shoulder. He appeared to be sedated and unconscious. I reflected for a minute, said a little prayer, and was starting to leave when the nurse came in to check on my soldier. She smiled, looked at his vitals, and asked me if I had any questions regarding his status. She informed me that both of his legs had been amputated and that he had serious blast injuries, but that his chance for survival was good. I thanked her for taking such great care of Ranger Bates, and I told her I would return when he was conscious. "Oh, he's conscious," she stated. "In fact, it would be good for you to talk with him." She gently shook the young ranger, who opened his eyes slightly and acknowledged my presence. "He can't speak right now," the nurse said, "but his mother was deaf, and he knows how to sign." The nurse handed me a sheet of paper with the various sign language symbols displayed on it. I talked for a minute, trying to find the strength to say the right thing. "What do you tell a young man who has lost both his legs serving his country? How do you make him feel better about his future?" Bates, his face swollen from the blast, his eyes barely visible through the redness and the bandages, stared at me momentarily. He must have sensed the pity in my expression. Raising his hand, he began to sign. I looked at each symbol on the sheet of paper before me. Slowly, painfully, he signed, "I will be okay," and then he fell back asleep. As I left the hospital that evening, I could not help but cry. Of the hundreds of men I talked with in the hospital, never once did anyone complain. Never once. They were proud of their service. They were accepting of their fate, and all they wanted to do was to get back to their unit, to be with the men that they had left behind. Somehow, Adam Bates personified all those men who had come before him. A year after my hospital visit in Afghanistan, I was at the 75th Ranger Regimental Change of Command. There in the stands was Ranger Bates, looking sharp in his dress uniform and standing tall on his new prosthetic legs. I overheard him challenge a number of his fellow Rangers to a pull-up contest. With all he had been through, the multiple surgeries, the painful rehab, and adjusting to a new life, he never quit. He was laughing, joking, smiling, and just as he promised me, he was okay. Life is full of difficult times, but someone out there always has it worse than you do. If you fill your days with pity, sorrowful for the way you have been treated, bemoaning your lot in life, blaming your circumstances on someone or something else, then life will be long and hard. If, on the other hand, you refuse to give up on your dreams, stand tall and strong against the odds, then life will be what you make of it, and you can make it great. Never, ever ring the bell. The University of Texas Commencement Speech, May 2014. The university's slogan is, "What starts here changes the world." I have to admit, I kind of like it. What starts here changes the world. Tonight, there are almost 8,000 students graduating from the University of Texas. That great paragon of analytical rigor, Ask.com, says that the average American will meet 10,000 people in their lifetime. That's a lot of folks. But if every one of you changed the lives of just 10 people, and each one of those folks changed the lives of another 10 people, just 10, then in five generations, 125 years, the class of 2014 will have changed the lives of 800 million people. 800 million people. Think of it. Over twice the population of the United States. Go one more generation, and you can change the entire population of the world, 8 billion people. If you think it's hard to change the lives of 10 people, change their lives forever, you're wrong. I saw it happen every day in Iraq and Afghanistan. A young Army officer makes a decision to go left instead of right down a road in Baghdad, and the 10 soldiers in his squad are saved from a close-in ambush. In Kandahar Province, Afghanistan, a non-commissioned officer from the female engagement team senses something isn't right and directs the infantry platoon away from a 500-pound IED, saving the lives of a dozen soldiers. But if you think about it, not only were these soldiers saved by the decisions of one person, but their children yet unborn were also saved, and their children's children were saved. Generations were saved by one decision, by one person. But changing the world can happen anywhere, and anyone can do it. So what starts here can indeed change the world. But the question is, what will the world look like after you change it? Well, I am confident that it will look much, much better. But if you will humor this old sailor for just a moment, I have a few suggestions that may help you on your way to a better world. And while these lessons were learned during my time in the military, I can assure you that it matters not whether you ever served a day in uniform. It matters not your gender, your ethnic or religious background, your orientation, or your social status. Our struggles in this world are similar, and the lessons to overcome those struggles and to move forward, changing ourselves and the world around us, will apply equally to all. I have been a Navy SEAL for 36 years. But it all began when I left UT for basic SEAL training in Coronado, California. Basic SEAL training is 6 months of long, torturous runs in the soft sand, midnight swims in the cold water off San Diego, obstacle courses, unending calisthenics, days without sleep, and always being cold, wet, and miserable. It is 6 months of being constantly harassed by professionally trained warriors who seek to find the weak of mind and body and eliminate them from ever becoming a Navy SEAL. But the training also seeks to find those students who can lead in an environment of constant stress, chaos, failure, and hardships. To me, Basic SEAL training was a lifetime of challenges crammed into 6 months. So here are the 10 lessons I learned from basic SEAL training that hopefully will be of value to you as you move forward in life. Every morning in basic SEAL training, my instructors, who at the time were all Vietnam veterans, would show up in my barracks room, and the first thing they would inspect was your bed. If you did it right, the corners would be square, the covers pulled tight, the pillow centered just under the headboard, and the extra blanket folded neatly at the foot of the rack. It was a simple task, mundane at best. But every morning, we were required to make our bed to perfection. It seemed a little ridiculous at the time, particularly in light of the fact that we were aspiring to be real warriors, tough, battle-hardened SEALs. But the wisdom of this simple act has been proven to me many times over. If you make your bed every morning, you will have accomplished the first task of the day. It will give you a small sense of pride, and it will encourage you to do another task, and another, and another. By the end of the day, that one task completed will have turned into many tasks completed. Making your bed will also reinforce the fact that little things in life matter. If you can't do the little things right, you will never do the big things right. And if by chance you have a miserable day, you will come home to a bed that is made, that you made. And a made bed gives you encouragement that tomorrow will be better. If you want to change the world, start off by making your bed. During SEAL training, the students are broken down into boat crews. Each crew is 7 students, 3 on each side of a small rubber boat, and 1 coxswain to help you guide the dinghy. Every day, your boat crew forms up on the beach and is instructed to get through the surf zone and paddle several miles down the coast. In the winter, the surf off San Diego can get to be 8 to 10 feet high, and it is exceedingly difficult to paddle through the plunging surf unless everyone digs in. Every paddle must be synchronized to the stroke count of the coxswain. Everyone must exert equal effort, or the boat will turn against the waves and be unceremoniously tossed back onto the beach. For the boat to make it to its destination, everyone must paddle. You can't change the world alone. You will need some help. And to truly get from your starting point to your destination takes friends, colleagues, the goodwill of strangers, and a strong coxswain to guide them. If you want to change the world, find someone to help you paddle. Over a few weeks of difficult training, my SEAL class, which started with 150 men, was down to just 42. There were now 6 boat crews of 7 men each. I was in the boat with the tall guys, but the best boat crew we had was made up of the little guys, the Munchkin crew, we called them. No one was over about 5'5". The Munchkin boat crew had 1 American Indian, 1 African American, 1 Polish American, 1 Greek American, 1 Italian American, and 2 tough kids from the Midwest. They out-paddled, out-ran, and out-swam all the other boat crews. The big men in the other boat crews would always make good-natured fun of the tiny little flippers the Munchkins put on their tiny little feet prior to every swim. But somehow these little guys, from every corner of the nation and the world, always had the last laugh, swimming faster than everyone and reaching the shore long before the rest of us. SEAL training was a great equalizer. Nothing mattered but your will to succeed, not your color, not your ethnic background, not your education, and not your social status. If you want to change the world, measure a person by the size of their heart, not the size of their flippers. Several times a week, the instructors would line up the class and do a uniform inspection. It was exceptionally thorough. Your hat had to be perfectly starched, your uniform immaculately pressed, and your belt buckle shiny and devoid of any smudges. But it seemed that no matter how much effort you put into starching your hat, or pressing your uniform, or polishing your belt buckle, it just wasn't good enough. The instructors would find something wrong. For failing the uniform inspection, the student had to run, fully clothed, into the surf zone, and then, wet from head to toe, roll around on the beach until every part of his body was covered with sand. The effect was known as a sugar cookie. You stayed in that uniform the rest of the day, cold, wet, and sandy. There were many students who just couldn't accept the fact that all their effort was in vain, that no matter how hard they tried to get the uniform right, it was unappreciated. Those students didn't make it through training. Those students didn't understand the purpose of the drill. You were never going to succeed. You were never going to have a perfect uniform. Sometimes, no matter how well you prepare or how well you perform, you still end up as a sugar cookie. It's just the way life is sometimes. If you want to change the world, get over being a sugar cookie and keep moving forward. Every day during training, you are challenged with multiple physical events: long runs, long swims, obstacle courses, and hours of calisthenics, something designed to test your mettle. Every event had standards, times you had to meet. If you failed to meet those standards, your name was posted on a list. And at the end of the day, those on the list were invited to a circus. A circus was 2 hours of additional calisthenics designed to wear you down, to break your spirit, to force you to quit. No one wanted a circus. A circus meant that, for that day, you didn't measure up. A circus meant more fatigue, and more fatigue meant that the following day would be more difficult, and more circuses were likely. But at some time during SEAL training, everyone made the circus list. But an interesting thing happened to those who were constantly on the list. Over time, those students who did 2 hours of extra calisthenics got stronger and stronger. The pain of the circuses built inner strength, built physical resiliency. Life is filled with circuses. You will fail. You will likely fail often. It will be painful. It will be discouraging. At times, it will test you to your very core. If you want to change the world, don't be afraid of the circuses. At least twice a week, the trainees were required to run the obstacle course. The obstacle course contained 25 obstacles, including a 10-foot-high wall, a 30-foot cargo net, and a barbed wire crawl, to name a few. But the most challenging obstacle was the slide for life. It had a 3-level, 30-foot tower at one end, and a 1-level tower at the other. In between was a 100-foot-long rope. You had to climb the 3-tiered tower, and once at the top, you grabbed the rope, swung underneath the rope, and pulled yourself hand over hand until you got to the other end. The record for the obstacle course had stood for years when my class began training in 1977. The record seemed unbeatable until one day a student decided to go down the slide for life head first. Instead of swinging his body underneath the rope and inching his way down, he bravely mounted the top of the rope and thrust himself forward. It was a dangerous move, seemingly foolish and fraught with risk. Failure could mean injury and being dropped from training. Without hesitation, the student slid down the rope perilously fast, and instead of several minutes, it took him only half that time. By the end of the course, he had broken the record. If you want to change the world, sometimes you have to slide down the obstacle head first. During the land warfare phase of training, the students are flown out to San Clemente Island, which lies off the coast of San Diego. The waters off San Clemente are a breeding ground for great white sharks. To pass SEAL training, there are a series of long swims that must be completed. One is the night swim. Before the swim, the instructors joyfully brief the trainees on all the species of sharks that inhabit the waters off San Clemente. They assure you, however, that no student has ever been eaten by a shark, at least not recently. But you are also taught that if a shark begins to circle your position, stand your ground. Do not swim away. Do not act afraid. And if the shark, hungry for a midnight snack, darts towards you, then summon up all your strength and punch him in the snout, and he will turn and swim away. There are a lot of sharks in the world. If you hope to complete the swim, you will have to deal with them. If you want to change the world, don't back down from the sharks. One of our jobs as Navy SEALs is to conduct underwater attacks against enemy shipping. We practiced this technique extensively during basic training. The ship attack mission is where a pair of SEAL divers is dropped off outside an enemy harbor, and then they swim well over 2 miles underwater using nothing but a depth gauge and a compass to get to their target. During the entire swim, even well below the surface, there is some light that comes through. It is comforting to know that there is open water above you. But as you approach the ship, which is tied to a pier, the light begins to fade. The steel structure of the ship blocks the moonlight. It blocks the surrounding street lamps. It blocks all ambient light. To be successful in your mission, you have to swim under the ship and find the keel, the center line and the deepest part of the ship. This is your objective. But the keel is also the darkest part of the ship, where you cannot see your hand in front of your face, where the noise from the ship's machinery is deafening, and where it is easy to get disoriented and fail. Every SEAL knows that under the keel, at the darkest moment of the mission, is the time when you must be calm, composed, when all your tactical skills, all your physical power, and all your inner strength must be brought to bear. If you want to change the world, you must be your very best in the darkest moment. The 9th week of training is referred to as Hell Week. It is 6 days of no sleep, constant physical and mental harassment, and one special day at the Mud Flats. The Mud Flats are an area between San Diego and Tijuana where the water runs off and creates the Tijuana Sloughs, a swampy patch of terrain where the mud will engulf you. It is on Wednesday of Hell Week that you paddle down to the Mud Flats and spend the next 15 hours trying to survive the freezing cold mud, the howling wind, and the incessant pressure from the instructors to quit. As the sun began to set that Wednesday evening, my training class, having committed some egregious infraction of the rules, was ordered into the mud. The mud consumed each man till there was nothing visible but our heads. The instructors told us we could leave the mud if only 5 men would quit. Just 5 men, and we could get out of the oppressive cold. Looking around the mud flats, it was apparent that some students were about to give up. It was still over 8 hours till the sun came up. 8 more hours of bone-chilling cold. The chattering teeth and shivering moans of the trainees were so loud it was hard to hear anything. And then, one voice began to echo through the night. One voice raised in song. The song was terribly out of tune, but sung with great enthusiasm. One voice became two, and two became three, and before long, everyone in the class was singing. We knew that if one man could rise above the misery, then others could as well. The instructors threatened us with more time in the mud if we kept up the singing, but the singing persisted, and somehow the mud seemed a little warmer, the wind a little tamer, and the dawn not so far away. If I have learned anything in my time traveling the world, it is the power of hope, the power of one person, a Washington, Lincoln, King, Mandela, and even a young girl from Pakistan, Malala. One person can change the world by giving people hope. If you want to change the world, start singing when you're up to your neck in mud. Finally, in SEAL training there is a bell, a brass bell that hangs in the center of the compound for all the students to see. All you have to do to quit is ring the bell. Ring the bell and you no longer have to wake up at 5 o'clock. Ring the bell and you no longer have to do the freezing cold swims. Ring the bell, and you no longer have to do the runs, the obstacle course, the PT, and you no longer have to endure the hardships of training. Just ring the bell. If you want to change the world, don't ever, ever ring the bell. To the graduating class of 2014, you are moments away from graduating, moments away from beginning your journey through life, moments away from starting to change the world for the better. It will not be easy. Start each day with a task completed. Find someone to help you through life. Respect everyone. Know that life is not fair and that you will fail often. But if you take some risks, step up when the times are toughest, face down the bullies, lift up the downtrodden, and never, ever give up, if you do these things, then the next generation and the generations that follow will live in a world far better than the one we have today. And what started here will indeed have changed the world for the better. Thank you very much. Hook 'em horns. Afterward, if you want to change your life, or maybe the world, remember, start each day with the task completed. Find someone to help you through life. Respect everyone. Know that life is not fair and that you will fail often. But if you take some risks, step up when times are toughest, face down the bullies, lift up the downtrodden, and never ever give up, if you do these things, then you can change your life for the better, and maybe the world. This has been a Hachette audio production of Make Your Bed, Little Things That Can Change Your Life and Maybe the World. Written and read by Admiral William H. McRaven, United States Navy, retired. Produced and directed by Lisa Kahn. Recorded by Phil Mazzetti at the Sound Lab. Post-production by A1 Sound Studio. Make Your Bed is available in print and digital formats from Grand Central Publishing, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2017 by William H. McRaven. Audio production copyright 2017, Hachette Audio, all rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this audiobook without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the audiobook, other than for review purposes, please contact permissions at hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights.